This is David Mitchell, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 29th of October, 2011. David Mitchell, Part 1.
David Mitchell, place of birth is Bridgend in South Wales, and 9th of the 4th, 63.
So you're now 40...
8.
48 years old, yeah. What was your education like, Dave?
Well, my dad travelled around... We travelled around with Dad and his work, so basically, I consider myself to be Welsh, much to everybody's annoyance at work, but I do follow Welsh rugby, and Mum and Dad are both Welsh. In fact, the whole family are Welsh, but we moved away when I was about 5. Dad went to work in Iran, working on a dam. So we travelled with him for a couple of years, and then we came back, and we lived in... near Bristol, and then we ended up in Scotland. Dad worked on the Hunterston nuclear power station when it was being built. So we ended up, I ended up, most of my education was effectively in a place called Ardrossan, which is where you catch the ferry to Arran, is probably where it's most famous for. And yeah, I spent most from sort of 6, 7 year old to... till 15 in the Scottish education system. And then when I moved down, when Dad moved down to the Lake District, I ended up in a position whereby I had one more year of my education to go before I did my O-levels. But it turns out when I came down here, all the subjects I'd been doing in Scotland, I couldn't do in England. So my educational results were poor, to say the least. Oh. So because of that, Not because of that, to be honest with you. I mean, Dad was an electrician, and I thought, well, you know, it's done him all right, I'll do the same. So I ended up an apprenticeship then at Sellafield, at BNFL, just on the coast there. And I guess that was my education, as it were. So was the apprenticeship, and obviously then the college after that. But certainly in terms of school stuff, it was fairly mixed, to say the least, really.
So no university for you then?
No, nothing. No, nothing like that. So, really, and I guess I could have chosen to choose any trade as under the apprenticeship scheme that was at the time, because it was obviously Sellafield was a big employer, and we had virtually guaranteed a job when you came out at the end of it, and people were kind of once you had a job at Sellafield, that was it, supposedly for life. But obviously, Dad had moved around a lot, and I knew that I wasn't intending to stay there long term, so I did a 4-year apprenticeship and an extra year at college or something like that, and then I wasn't really looking for anything else, but just Mum had seen an advert in the paper for Bath, electricians wanted, and she said that'll be all right for you. You apply for that.
Most mothers don't want their sons to go that far.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? It is funny. I mean, she definitely found the ad and sort of put it in front of me and said, "Oh, you know, you might be interested in that," because I had very little interest in the outdoors. Although living in the Lake District, we obviously we had it on our doorsteps, but the peer group I hung around with, or my friends, you know, we were into kind of a bit of canoeing maybe and windsurfing and that kind of thing. But I really wasn't into climbing, mountaineering, wilderness type things. I used to go camping with my grandparents all the time. Wherever we went back down to Wales, we'd always go camping. And I really love camping. But nothing that was really pushing me to the kind of the wilderness experience, to be honest. More or less, it was just enjoyable. So why on earth my mum thought I'd be interested in the Antarctic, I've got no idea.
Did you know much about the Antarctic?
I knew nothing about the Antarctic.
You'd not read about Scott and Shackleton? And...
No, nothing at all. It was a completely... completely. Open book. I had no preconceptions or anything. It was just, well, it looks interesting, and I'll give it a go and see what happens, really.
So that must have been a bit of a handicap at the interview, then, if you didn't even know anything about it.
It's quite interesting, because Eric Salmon interviewed me, who was the HR man at the time, very much a character. And at the interview, I do recall that it was quite a short-term lead-up to going south. I know now, looking back, because I think the interview was in October, and it was due for immediate departure. I think one electrician that they had at Signy had, for whatever reason, had come home or something had happened, so they're looking for somebody short-term, you know, on a short notice. And the following day, Eric Salmon rang me up, and he said, "Oh, medical notwithstanding, we'd like to offer you a job." And that was a big surprise to me, because it's one thing applying for a job in the Antarctic, but the next thing is, you know, do I want a job in the Antarctic? That's two totally different things, knowing nothing about it. Mm. But it turns out I failed the medical.
On what grounds?
When I was 12, I had a stomach ulcer, and which has never given me any problems since. But it was obviously, it was a tick in the, or a cross in the box, if you like, of the medical examiner. And there was no time to do any follow-up, because the departure was going to be fairly short afterwards. So he rang me back and said, "I've got some bad news. You failed the medical." And he said, "I don't know what it is," because obviously the medical practitioner wasn't going to tell Eric as to what it was. But he said, "With your permission, I'd like to look into it." I said, "Yeah, no problem." He said, "All right, we've got this issue," he said. "Unfortunately, we can't offer you a position immediately, but would you be interested in next year's intake," which obviously was going to be in June, July time. And that suited me much better, because I had time to think about it and really think about what I wanted to do and what was going to happen. So yeah, I said in principle I'd take it, and obviously in 6 months later, I started with Bass, but I don't recall reading up much on the Antarctic, to be honest with you, in the meantime. It may be my poor memory, but I don't recall researching a great deal, other than I did work at Cambridge for a few months, which was, for electricians, was unusual. It was mostly the mechanics that worked in the garage downstairs and got everything ready, but for some reason they had me there for a few months. So I guess in that period from sort of June to September, that's when I kind of picked up most of the knowledge. I had no idea as to what base I was going to, or what the differences between the bases were. He just said, "Oh, you're going to base F." And I said, "Oh, fine." Didn't know what base F was, but yeah, that'll be great. I'm sure it'll be great, and that was it.
Did you have to reapply, or was the post held open for you?
No, I believe it was held open for me. I don't recall going for another interview.
Right.
I don't recall that.
So the clock ticked round, and they rang you up and said, "Are you coming or not?"
Yeah, ticked round. He said, "Yeah, I'd like to offer you a position."
Were you still at Sellafield?
I was, yeah, I was. And everybody, when I handed my notice in, everybody was like, "Well, you know, you'll never go. Nobody leaves here. This is where I'm leaving." Because, well, you know, I guess at the time people thought job for life, then, you know, why would you want to throw it away?
So they didn't know how to organise a leaving party then at Sellafield?
No, we did have a leaving party. I do recall having a leaving party and being none too worse away for it. But yeah, no, I mean, I had a lot of good friends there and I enjoyed working there, but I don't know what it was. I just wanted something different.
So you went to the Cambridge conference, I presume?
Yes, yes.
How was that? Because that was the first time you were mixing with people you were going to work with.
It was. I mean, I was working with some of the mechanics, obviously, at headquarters, because there was a lot of people there who were going south, mostly mechanics. And plus, because I'd been working in Cambridge, you tend to obviously mix with the people who have just come back and the people who are going to be there during the summer, if not the winter. So I was fairly well, I wouldn't say established, but I knew my way around before the conference. But the conference was great because obviously you get to meet the people that you're actually going to be wintering with. Because at the time when I applied, when they said to me, "Well, you'd be going for 2 years," it was like, "What's 2 years?" I mean, I couldn't really get my head around that, because I thought it would just be, "Oh, you go for 6 months, a year, you come back and then go down again." But obviously that wasn't the case. But no, I enjoyed the conference, and the intake for that winter was only going to be, I'm trying to think now, I think there was only three of us anyway who was adding to the numbers that were there. It was a small intake for base F. But yeah, there was no real standout moments at the conference. It was just good to mix with people, really, I think, and just get a feel for who else was going down. a lot of people were sailing down, but I was flying in.
Now, why was that?
And I don't know why now. I'm trying to recall why. But a lot of people were sailing down. There must have been some work going on in Cambridge that I had to finish off, I suspect.
So I went later?
Yeah, I went... Well, I went later, but got in earlier, because I think I flew something like the 20th of October or something like that, picked up the Biscoe and Stanley, and then obviously went straight down from there.
You were able to fly because of the Falklands War?
Yes. There was no... Obviously, prior to that, there were no flights to the Falklands. In actual fact, I think it's true to say that we were on the first commercial flight to the Falklands, TriStar flight. It had been a military operation before that, I think, on VC-10s, but it wasn't open to the public. And I think this is the first. I think it was the first time that the TriStar had landed at Ascension Island, and certainly the first time it had landed at the Falklands. So I guess that unbeknown to me at the time, that was obviously a brand new routine, which at the time I wasn't aware of, that you'd have to go via Montevideo or Rio beforehand.
Did you spot a welcoming party then?
Oh, it was very bleak. I remember it being very bleak. Because there was no terminal building or anything like there is now. It was just a hangar. And it was very windy and it was wet. And I think, yeah, that's right. We just turned up at Mount Pleasant, got in a bus, and we were just taken directly to the ship, the Biscoe, which was at the time, it was actually docked in Port Stanley itself, mm-hmm. Which obviously doesn't happen anymore. But I do remember getting off the bus, looking over the edge of the dock and thinking, that can't be the ship, because it seems so small. Obviously the tide was out, so that's why it was way down, but... it just really seemed really, really small.
Apparently, it looks small when the tide's in as well.
Yeah, it's not a big ship, but you know, I think, however you get to the Antarctic, you tend to have an affinity with the vessel that you've been on, and I've been on most of them in my career, certainly from the Biscoe up beyond anyway. I've always got a great kind of fondness for the Biscoe. It's a lovely little ship, really. Because actually, a few years later, when I came back down again, I actually sailed all the way down on the Biscoe. So, I'm very familiar with that vessel.
How soon was it, once the Biscoe had left Port Stanley, how soon was it before you realised you were hooked on the Antarctic?
I think before I got on the Biscoe, I think the moment I got on the Biscoe, to be honest with you, I realised that this was actually something quite special. I was never seasick, but I do remember in the first few days sitting on the back of the, because obviously wooden decks on the Biscoe, sitting on the back, looking out, just keep my eyes on the horizon just to make sure that I wasn't going to be sick. And I just sat there for hours just looking out the back, and obviously the albatrosses would come, and I just kept thinking, yeah, this is just fantastic.
First iceberg?
Yeah, I mean... It's in the diary, seeing the first iceberg today, but I have no real recollection of it. To be honest with you, the first recollection I have is we dropped off a field party at James Ross Island, and which is interesting for me because I got a chance to go to James Ross Island a number of years later in a field party. And it just so happens that the people that are on that field party are good friends of mine now, actually, and here today, but I didn't know them at the time. But I ended up in a cabin with a couple of guys who have ended up being kind of, you know, lifelong friends, and they were all, they'd already done seasons before, so I was, you know, very much the greenhorn, to be honest with you. But then these guys got dropped from James Ross Island on the sea ice with skidoos and sledges, and I kept thinking, oh, fantastic, you know, that's for me. You know, what do I need to do to be able to get onto on a field trip, really? Even though I knew very little about it, it just really, I don't know what it was about it, just being left, you know, to your own devices for obviously periods of time. And it just so happened that the sledges that the following day the skidoos went through the ice. Brian, a friend of mine, I keep reminding him about that. But yeah, I don't know what happened there, but obviously the ice wasn't great, and that kind of also brings it home to you, really, how fragile the whole thing is between sort of having an existence or having supplies and what have you to exist, and suddenly having nothing. So
yeah, you learn quite quickly how dangerous it could be down there.
Yes, but it's funny enough, I never really thought of it as dangerous. When I think back now about some of the stuff we used to do, I think it would frighten me more now because of the amount of experience I have. At the time, it was just, well, this is what we do, you know, this is how it is. And I didn't really have that feeling of danger, but very aware of your surroundings and the wilderness, really. Yeah. And then I think from James Ross Island, we ended up going to Palmer Station, which is the American base close to... Actually, I think first I went to Livingston and dropped off Ash Morton.
He's here.
Yeah, Ash is here, yeah. I know Ash. Well, and he was part of a field trip that was on Livingston Island. But this, again, to me, this is all new, and it didn't really mean anything. It was just field parties on islands. And then ended up at Palmer Station, you know, having a few beers with the Americans, because Palmer Station and Base F, because they're only kind of 30, 40 miles away as the crow flies, tend to have quite a rapport between them, really, so... Met up with some of the guys who'd be wintering at Palmer Station.
Was there a, I mean, I know we're leaping ahead slightly because you haven't got to Faraday yet, but was there a significant difference in the culture of Palmer Station and Faraday?
Completely.
In what way?
Completely different. The Americans seemed to have everything, and we had nothing. It was that kind of effect. And obviously they only did restricted tours. So whereas we were wintering for 2 years, they would do a summer or they'd do a winter. I think it was unlike, and very rarely would do a summer and a winter, and certainly not any more than one winter at the time. So the base was very modern, obviously, relatively recent.
Well provisioned?
You're very well provisioned, and they gave us a lot of... I mean, over the years at Faraday, they used to send lots of food down for us, things that we obviously couldn't get hold of. And we had a great relationship with the guys at Palmer Station, to be honest with you. Yeah.
What was Faraday like when you got there? I mean, you'd seen one or two other bases on the way down, but when you suddenly came face-to-face with the facilities at Faraday, knowing you were going to be there for 2 years...
Fell completely in love with Faraday. We came through Lemaire Channel. I remember thinking, this is just unbelievable. We went past Peterman Island, where Sharko wintered, and then, obviously, an hour or so later, we're in Meek Channel. I do remember seeing the base, thinking, wow, this is just an unbelievable setting. Got off, because the winters, I think we were allowed to go ashore first because we were wintering, so we were dropped off at the jetty and went up to meet guys that were leaving that from that year, and obviously the guys that were staying on for another year, which is the first time obviously we'd met them. And I was just blown away by the whole thing, to be honest with you. It couldn't have been any better as far as I was concerned. It just looked great. It was perfect. Yeah.
So what happened? It wasn't exactly an enormous house you were going to live in, was it?
No, I guess by modern standards it's probably quite small, but there again, historically it's probably quite big. Mm. You know, it's where you sit in the whole scheme of things, isn't it, really? It's obviously been extended within the last 4 years.
Was it dormitory style in those days?
It was. It was four people to a room. I say dormitory style. Four people to a room. It wasn't like it was, for example, at Bird Island when I went there later, where everybody was in the same room. It wasn't like that. It had been improved in 1982, and obviously now this is 85, so it had a relative upgrade between the start of the 80s and 85. But It was a nice base. It wasn't too big. It wasn't too small. It was nice, and you know, I fell in love with it straight away. Really.
What were the electrics like?
Well, from my point of view, it was poor. I mean, because I'd used to come from an industrial kind of, you know, nuclear kind of background where things are a bit more kind of stringent. So for me, there was a lot to go at, really. I love being an electrician. I enjoy the hands-on stuff. And so it was great for me. And what I really liked about it was I was left on my own. I could do things how I wanted. I wasn't restricted by people telling me what to do or other people there kind of influencing what I could do. So I just kind of, to be honest with you, I just set about rewiring the whole place, really, virtually from top to bottom.
Where do you get the resources from? How do you order them and brought them down with you?
There was Tony Escott was, he was the next winter and he at Rotherham, and he recruited me. He was in charge of, he was the electrical engineer back at Bass. And he just said, whatever you want, just ask for it the previous year and I'll get it sent down. And it just so happened that there was plenty of stuff left over from when it had been extended in the 80s. And the electricians previously, for whatever reason, had left well alone. So there was lots of stock there, to be honest with you. So I had plenty to go at. And I just kind of worked my way through that, really. And obviously would order things for other bases or get things sent down.
Were you being innovative?
Yeah, I like to think so. I mean, because things were very much, very primitive in terms of how the electrical system was put together. And I'd come from a more automated background. So I set about kind of automating things that could be automated.
Such as?
Well, it was at a time where they just put sea flush toilets in because they'd gone from Elsands that year, and there was all sorts of problems with the water supplies to them and the pumps, everything else, and the pumps would burn out kind of once every couple of weeks. So I just kind of automated it so that if any faults came up, that they'd sort of trigger alarms and that kind of thing. So that rather than replacing pumps, you'd be able to do something beforehand, before the actual failure came on. So I just spent a lot of time doing that, really, and I really enjoyed it. You know, I enjoy doing what I do, and I just, to be honest with you, I just started at one room. I just worked around all the rooms until they were virtually all rewired, or I did what I could with them, really.
Were you having to put heating wires in around pipes and so on to keep the water flowing? Was that your job, or was that the plumber?
Yeah, there was no plumber. It was just me, really. It was me and the diesel mechanic. It was Steve Eady, who was very experienced. He'd come from Halley. He'd done 3 winters at Halley. He'd obviously been at F. And the kind of the trace heating stuff now, which you get now, is very efficient, whereas back then it was really quite in its infancy. And you get a lot of potentially quite dodgy situations with sort of heat catching fire because it would overheat because it'd be a short circuit and all the rest of it. So I kind of designed a system whereby it would monitor the heat trace, and if it came up with any faults, because what would happen is that you wouldn't know whether it was on or off because it'd be buried in snow, and the first thing you'd know was the pipe was frozen. So I came up with some kind of circuit whereby we'd be able to, the guy who was on nights or whatever, would be able to look at a control panel and sort of say, oh yeah, the heat traces are fine, you know, no problem. But if they went off for any reason, it would bring up an alarm, which would then mean we could then knock the pumps off, drain the pumps out, drain the pipes out, so that we weren't having to then defrost huge lengths of pipe, which were just, you know, sometimes you'd spend days digging pipes out just to defrost and put back together again, and a week later they'd be frozen again. So I did quite a lot of stuff like that, really, which is nothing now, but at the time it was kind of, you know, it was certainly for Faraday, it was quite a jump forward, really. So
I'm just wondering about the how reliable the generators were, because that's the other bugbear for electricians and Fizz generally.
Generators were very reliable. They were Volvo Pentas, and I mean, to be honest with you, Steve obviously looked after the mechanical side of things, and he was very, very good. He knew his stuff. And we very rarely had any problems with generators at all. I could probably count on two hands the number of power cuts we had in 2 years.
Did it get out much?
Well, that I mean, that's why I kind of took on to it, really, because I just couldn't believe the opportunity that I had to be able to pick up so many new skills. I was very fortunate. The people that I hooked up with in the summer, and because I think there was 12 or 13 of us. I think the base slept up to 24 in the summer. I think there was about 16 people there in the summer, and there was 10 of us in the first winter. And the guys who, there was some keen people there who liked skiing and getting out and travelling. And that first summer, I just recall at every opportunity putting skis on. I'd never skied before, but putting cross-country skis on. And we had small 12-foot fiberglass dinghies called Tepcos with 3.5 horsepower Seagull engines. And we used to go everywhere in theirs, everywhere. I mean, and it comes back to that kind of perception of danger, because there's no way I would, some of the seas that we were going out in, there's no way I'd do that now. We go across to the mainland at every opportunity to climb hills and what have you, and you know, the water would be breaking over the front of the little, I mean, we'd only be doing sort of 3-4 mile an hour. That was a Seagull engine flat out, and it would take us an hour or so to get to the mainland, and we'd just be there all the time. I've gone back through my diaries just to have a look, and I'm just astounded by how much time we spent out skiing and climbing and in the boats, and because it just would seem that you do a full day's work, you'd have dinner, then you just go out for another sort of 5 hours, and or you think, oh, the weather's good now, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, let's go to the mainland, climb a hill, and come back, and it would, and that would be a 10-hour round trip. So you'd be getting back at sort of, you know, 1-2 in the morning, obviously with sun still up, and then grabbing a few hours kit, and then you'd be back up for work in the morning. It was just, I'd forgotten a lot, actually, but when you actually go back and you think, we did a hell of a lot of stuff, obviously all recreational, don't get me wrong, it's nothing that was a requirement by Bass to do, it was just purely recreational, just because we wanted to.
Were you taking what you would now regard to be a risk? From time to time, when you were traveling,
definitely.
Such as,
I think the riskiest thing was certainly the boats. For me, anyway, was the boats, because they were so small. The engine was so unreliable. The water expanse to the mainland and all the other islands we used to go to. I mean, it had a huge fetch to it. And sometimes, if you go into two little boats, they might be kind of 20 metres apart, but you'd only see each other when you're on the top of the crest of a wave. It was mad. And but it was just the accepted thing. And it wasn't anything out of the ordinary at all. Whereas now, I think you'd struggle to get me in that boat. I mean, when it got to the winter time and the sea ice travel, I mean, we used to do a lot of stuff there, which I think with experience now I realise was foolhardy. But you get away with it. And if you get away with it, then I guess you keep on doing it, and that's how you learn.
So the base commander at that time was not sort of breathing down your neck saying, don't do this?
He didn't really know, to be honest with you. And I'm sure he'd laugh, because he, in his own mind, he knew. But he was...
It was unspoken.
It was unspoken, really, yeah. I mean, we went to Petermann Island one trip. In fact, my first ever field trip was only for a few days. We never went for very long. And I was with one of the second-year winters, and we traversed around the island on foot. And we're traversing above some cliffs. And bearing in mind, I'd only been there 3 weeks. I had the wrong footwear on. I had no ice axe. And I slipped. And I slid down the slope for about 200 feet. And there was a cliff edge. Literally. I have been looking through the diary. And literally another 20 feet away. And that was 150 foot vertical. And I just managed to stop myself on my fingernails. And I remember somebody always saying to me, always carry your FID knife with you. I took it out of pocket and I just cut steps in this ice slope and got back up to safety. And I think now, if I hadn't managed to stop myself, at best I would have had a couple of broken legs and fairly serious injury. But I would have been taken home, I would have been flown home, or shipped home. I wouldn't, you know, that would have been at best, really. And I always wonder if I hadn't managed to stop myself with that sort of 20 feet to go, and it literally was that, you know, whether anything that has happened since would have been there.
Did that change your approach to field work?
It made me think that I needed to be more, I wouldn't say the word professional, that's not right, but I needed to think more about what I was doing and why I was doing
more
it.
More circumspect.
Yeah, because I was just basically following other people at that point. And then I thought, no, that's not the way to do it. You know, it needs to be a little bit more structured as to, it's okay doing those things, but make sure you're properly equipped to do it. So although we did a lot of travel in the summer and the winter that was considered to be obviously out of travel limits and in some people's eyes, very, very risky, we were always as prepared, as best prepared as we possibly could be. I spent a lot of time going through lots of different types of kit to take and what the best thing was. Because the difference, what I liked about Faraday was, that wasn't anywhere on any other basis, that there was no field assistance, so virtually you were left to your own devices. And there was no skidoos. So everything was on foot.
No dogs.
Husky. No dogs. They'd gone before at the late 70s, if you like. So probably about 5 years earlier. So all travel was basically on foot, on ski, under your own power. And I was keen to make things as lightweight as possible, but also as best prepared as possible. So that all the travelling that we did was, in my eyes at the time, as safe as it could be. But at the same time, obviously, you were just left to your own device. There was nobody professional there who were climbers or anything like that. It was just a matter of picking things up, reading books. And we had a visit at the end of the first summer. We had a visit from two field assistants from Rotherham who were coming in basically to show us a bit of field craft. Which I obviously latched onto straight away, and fortunate enough, I got on some really good trips with them. I mean, bizarrely enough, this is slightly off the point, but one of the guys, Alistair, where I work now, which is on a wind farm offshore on the Cumbrian coast, he turned up 2 weeks ago to do a job. And he said, "I know you." I said, "I know you as well." And We'd seen each other once since 1986, and that was again bizarrely on a glacier in Chamonix, where we had a fleeting passing moment where we kind of said hello, and he just turned up to actually do some work for me now, sort of what 30 years later. So it's incredible, really, how you meet how the people that you meet down south always turn up at other stages.
When you said travel limits, what did you mean? Was this some sort of regulation laid down by the base commander about how far you can go or the kind of terrain you can go over? What do you mean by travel limits?
There was always a limit as to how far recreationally you could go at various times of the year. So there were boating limits. So, for example, you couldn't go beyond the Berthelow Islands to the south, Peterman Island to the north, the Forge Islands to the west, and obviously the mainland. But they were limits, but they're really impossible to enforce, because if Cambridge didn't know you were going beyond, then they would never know that you were outside the
limits. Right, so they were imposed by Cambridge rather than base commander.
Imposed by Cambridge.
And were they arbitrary or were they sensible?
I thought, well, looking back now, I would say they were fairly more than sensible, to be honest with you. Quite a long way to go on those little boats. And in the wintertime, obviously, there was then skiing limits, how far you could ski on the sea ice in those same directions and also on the mainland, how far you could go on the mainland and what mountains you were allowed to climb and what mountains you weren't allowed to climb. And again, they were set down by Cambridge as well.
And were they universally ignored?
No, not at all, really. They weren't universally ignored. I mean, that would be unfair to say that. I think there was a few people who were keen to push, not to break the limits because there was a limit there. That was never the case, just because they wanted to see what was beyond the limits. You know, if you're allowed to go to here, I just wonder what's around the corner. And that's all it was, really. It wasn't to think, well, we've got to go out and break the travel limits. That wasn't really the case. It was really all to do with what's round the corner? What can I see from the top of that hill?
But I gather that you would much like to have been able to go further down the coast, wouldn't you? Particularly down the peninsula.
Well, we were, but again, only to a certain point, which affects
Prospect Point.
Prospect Point, which was somewhere we always wanted to go, was way out of limits. Way out of limits. But we always talked about, well, if we had the chance, would we go down to Prospect Point? And that was always the thing, to get to Prospect Point, because it seemed such a long way away, based on what our limits were. So it was really just in the bar on a Saturday night, let's go to Prospect Point. But really, to be honest with you, that was a bit far even for us to kind of contemplate going down there.
Well, all this, of course, is man-hauling, and this is where you were introduced to the interesting art of man-hauled sledges.
Yeah.
So how do you take to that kind of thing? As we'll discover later, it became something of an obsession.
Well, I just started to read every book there was on polar history and exploration. It was just the fact that it was just you on your sledge, or you and your companions on your sledge or sledges, that it was just so pure. I just really thought, this is the only thing that can really link what I'm doing now to what Scott Shackleton and all those guys did, a long time ago. Because the conditions were the same. The sledges at Faraday were virtually identical. So it really was, how much can you pull and how far can you pull it and how long are you prepared to pull it for, really? And obviously within our limits, it was going to be very, very restricted. But it did give you a flavour of what it was actually like, 80-odd years ago, really. And as I say, I just read up on everything I could possibly read up on in terms of...
So the very act of man-hauling kind of connected you back to the heroic age?
Definitely. Definitely. Without a shadow of a doubt. And I really took to it. I liked the physicalness of it. I liked the way that, obviously, you had to be fit. And I also liked the games in the mind that it used to play with you, about how far you're prepared to push yourself. Mm. But you can only imagine what it's like for, obviously, Scott and Nansen and people like that. But it did give you a connection with it.
You did get to Prospect Point in the end, didn't you?
I did, yeah. We did get there. More recently working for Morrison Construction, who were doing a kind of a clean-up of the old bases on the peninsula, and we got fortunate enough to get to Prospect Point. And a number of other also famous huts as well, which is great, really, to be honest with you. It kind of lost its meaning a little bit, I guess, because time moves on and you have a different view on the Antarctic and why you're there and everything, and obviously you've got all your experiences in between, and it depends where it sits on that level, but it was great to get there. Yeah. And sort of think, well, yeah, we're here, here at last, really, if you like. But equally on that same trip, it was fantastic to go back to Faraday because I hadn't been back since the early 90s, and it hadn't changed. It was just great.
out of chronology, but whilst we're talking about this, what kind of work were you doing at these old bases? Was it just basically just tidying up?
Obviously, with the... there was a requirement now to remove all your rubbish, if you like, from the Antarctica, unless it's designated as a site of special historical interest. And some of the huts are and some of the huts haven't been. And it was just fortunate for me that we had a chance to get to a lot of the island-like detail. Went to Dalmy as well, actually, but Prospect Point, quite a few of the wee huts up the peninsula. Really, it was great just to visit them and be able to stay a few days.
Were they largely untouched?
No, I think those days have gone, really. I mean, what you really notice, especially sort of late 80s onwards, is the number of yachts and tourists visiting the peninsula. And all those old huts tend to be a magnet for...
They've been scavenged.
They've been scavenged, yeah, and they've been visitors and they've been trashed and people have wintered in them and not shut the door and all that. So they tend to fall apart, to be honest with you. So yeah, I think the advent of tourism per se, and I'm talking about people in yachts as well, because effectively if you come down the yacht, you can do what you like and go where you like, then depending on your view as to why you're there, depends really on what you're doing. And obviously if people want to strip a building bare of all of historical interest, and that's what's going to happen, unfortunately. But I mean, that's one thing that at Faraday was the number of yachts we used to get in.
Even in the 80s?
Well, mainly Sally and Jerome Ponce, but also people on Cotique and Northanger and yachts like that. But we used to go out on the yachts then. We'd go off for a day. Jerome would take us off down the coast and we'd have the sail up and it's great. Especially the regular visitors, and those on Pelagic as well, you get quite friendly with them. So, you look forward to them coming in for a few days and having a chat, catching up with people and maybe going off for a sail and coming back. And again, I don't think that was strictly kosher in terms of what Cambridge would like you to do. But, like I say, these things happen, don't they?
Were there scientists based at Faraday at that time?
Yeah, it was an upper atmospheric...
Right, so you were having to supply them with the electricity they required.
And experiments. To be honest with you, I embraced the whole thing, completely immersed myself. I was really into a lot of the stuff that they were doing. I'd help out with the VLF experiments. There's a guy called Mark Clovered, who I went to with the first year, who's still working for Bass now. We're very good friends and... I used to do his obs for him, and obviously if you're on nights, you used to do met obs and that kind of thing. I just got right into the whole thing. There was nothing about Faraday or the people I was with or the work that was done that I found to be a chore. I just loved every minute of it.
There's a story about the first mail drop, which didn't go quite according to plan.
No, because at the time, after the last ship left, whenever it was in March or whatever, then you used to get 50 words on the telex a month. and the first mail, actually written mail, used to come in either on the first ship, which was obviously going to be in December sometime generally. But the the Twin Otters used to fly south to Rothera generally around October time. And there was always some mail on that flight for you. But on this occasion, first flight down, Morris, who was the radio operator going into Rothera, and he held his hand up afterwards and admitted his failings. But instead of kicking the mail out when the light turned green, he kicked it out when the first red light came on. So it ended up several miles away up the coast. And obviously we were just on the island group waiting for the mail. And we said, where is it? On the radio, and the planes were flying around. I thought, what's going on? And then obviously the planes just headed south for Rothera. I said, what's happened? And then Morris came on the radio and said, "Oh, I'm sorry, guys, I've kicked your mail out a bit early. It's somewhere to the north." But fortunately for us, we still had reasonably good sea ice. So a couple of the guys went off looking for it, and we think we found it about 3 days later.
Dry.
Dry. Well, it's in a plastic bag, so it was fine. Yeah, so we were quite lucky there, really.
Had you left anybody behind?
Just my parents, two sisters, and
so,
again,
so letters were important to you then?
They were, yeah. Yeah, and I think mail's important, full stop. I mean, even now, in the advent of emails and the internet and sort of constant communication that's available now, I think everybody likes getting a letter, don't they? And yeah, it was important. And I used to make time and effort to write a lot of letters back to my parents. You know, I used to keep a diary and keep a running log and sort of send that back to them, really, because it was really the only kind of personal contact that they had. They had actually just installed satellite telephones into the base in 1986, which was the year I arrived. But, I mean, that was like £9 a minute. And I think the weekly wage was something like £70 a week or something, so there wasn't a lot of time spent on the phone.
You did your 2 years at Faraday. Were you then due to go home again, or was there always a plan to move you on somewhere else?
I was due to go home.
What happened?
Well, what did happen? I just had a telex from Tony back at Cambridge asking me if I were prepared not to go home, but to go straight to Bird Island and do a job there, which was only supposedly going to take a month or so. I thought, great, yeah, we'll go there, no problem at all. I mean, I always wanted to go to Bird Island, and
this was wiring the extension, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. And to be honest with you, the chippy who I wintered with in the first winter at Faraday, he was going there to do the extension as well, so it would be the two of us that would be there doing that. And, yeah, it was great. I mean, at the time, I think, I thought, well, it's only an extra month. It's not really going to make much difference, really, but it ended up being sort of an extra sort of 3 or 4 months. But it was great. I enjoyed it, really, yeah.
You left Bird Island on, it says here, an RFA. I'm not quite sure what an RFA is.
Royal Fleet Auxiliary Vessel.
Right. There's a story about that?
There is a story about that, because we, the weather was pretty bad, and I was due to, what was happening was, is that I was quite happy to stay at Bird Island, but Cambridge wanted me to come back and then go back down south again. So I said, fair enough, I'll come back, I'll go home and then think about coming back down again. And obviously at that time of the year, sort of July, August, then the only vessels around would be military supply vessels up in the north, obviously, sub-Antarctic Island. But anyway, they would come pick me up. So we waited quite a long time for the weather to change, and the weather became marginally better, and the RFA was just off Bird Sound. And they came in a a semi-rigid inflatable with, you know, with I think it was two officers and a marine came in to pick me up off the foreshore, and it was very rough. Fortunately, it was an onshore wind. But as they were coming to pick me up, I think they went to put the vessel, the rib into reverse to slow it down, and the propeller dropped off. So all we knew at the time was some frantic kind of looking over the side, the oars coming out, and then sort of paddling through the ice and the swell to get ashore. And we just said, what's happened? So the propeller's come off. And effectively the weather was that poor then that they were stuck on Bird Island with us as well until they could get another rib out to pick us up. But that the rib that came for me the first time, it ended up sinking on the foreshore, to be honest with you. And it's still there to this day. Because when I went back to Bird Island in 2005, I had a wander around to the beach, and it's still, I mean, it's fairly much buried now on the foreshore, but it's still there. So it's been there a long time. But yeah, an expensive piece of military equipment lost for the sake of a propeller. But it's an interesting story.
They brought you back in July 88, I guess by that time Bass felt 2.5 years was long enough. But it wasn't an awfully long time before you went south again.
No.
Did you reapply more straight away?
They wanted me to go back to Bird Island, but I wanted to be a field GA. I wanted to basically go and have a field trip.
Hmm.
And they were keen for me to go back to Bird Island. And they said, OK, if you go back to Bird Island early, I'd been home a few weeks, finish Bird Island off, and then you can go on the James Ross Island cruise as a field assistant. So that's what I did, effectively. But this time I sailed down on the Bisco, so I sailed down from Grimsby, obviously through Montevideo, onto Bird Island, finished off there, and then went on the James Ross Island cruise with... I think it was 22 scientists, and there was 4 field assistants, and we worked off James Ross Island for a couple of months, and it was brilliant. I loved it. It was great.
What was the pattern of the work? You were staying on the ship, were you?
No, we spent about half the time on the ship, but we had about a month ashore on James Ross Island, where myself and Crispin Day. We actually had 4x4 ATVs, all-terrain vehicles, because from the previous trip, where I talked about where they lost the skidoos through the ice, they realised that they had a... Because James Ross Island, a lot of it's dry, so there's no snow on it. So they fitted skidoos with a wheel on the front, which was effectively a complete disaster, because they just kept digging themselves into the ground. So they went back this time with ATVs. So we had these ATVs with effectively trailers acting as sledges on the back. And we'd traverse to the other side of the island, Crispin and myself, and then we'd have different scientists come to stay with us for different lengths of time, depending on what their speciality was. And then we'd take them around the hills so they could carry out their experiments. So yeah, it was a bit of a mixed trip, but it was great. And that's when the chap there called Jerry Hooker, and he discovered a dinosaur, which at the time was the second dinosaur ever to be found in Antarctica.
Did you see it?
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously with him. It was Tim Whitkin was one of the other GAs, and he was with him when they found it. And then we all went over and we spent some time, effectively, as to the layman. He had a lot of baker's baskets, if you like, stacked up maybe 5 or 6 high, with different degrees of filtering between them, different mesh sizes, and it just looked like he was just throwing pebbles into this top basket. But what they were bones. They were fossilized bones. And nothing, I don't think anything was bigger than, the palm, well, no, even smaller than that. You know, thumb size, really, was probably the biggest piece, down to something the size of your small nail. And he had bags and bags of these things, which looked like pebbles to me, but obviously not to him. And it still remains to this day one of the most amazing things I've ever seen, is to watch Jerry sit in the lab on the Bisco and glue these bits together. And within a week, he had the bottom half of a jaw and of a jawbone and the back of the skull of this dinosaur. From these bits, which, to be honest with you, were unrecognisable as bones, but he just knew exactly what he was looking at, and he could just piece it all together. It was incredible to watch somebody so skilled at what they do, do something like that. And I've never been to see it, but and I don't know if it's still on display, but it was in the Natural History Museum in London. But I've never been down to see if it's still there.
So did you get the whole animal, or was it just the skull?
He got, I'll be lying for a second to remember, but I think he had about 30% of it. It was right. about a 6-foot dinosaur. And I think the rest of it, they kind of went, obviously, I've not seen it, but they made the rest of it up with, obviously, plastic components. But they had, you know, the real thing there on display, really.
Enough to get a good ID.
Oh, definitely. Definitely, yeah. I mean, certainly most of the head was there, I think. And it's incredible to see.
How do you... the concept of the Antarctic having had dinosaurs is not an obvious one, unless you've studied plate tectonics.
Exactly, yeah.
So was it a bit of a shock to you to find out that underneath all this ice and snow there was vegetation and...
It wasn't a shock to me because, obviously, I'd spent a couple of years there and I'd picked up quite a lot from the people I was with. the people who were camping with, you know, at James Ross Island, they were all geologists. So obviously the parting information to you about ammonites and all sorts of stuff, really. So, and one, I mean, another amazing thing, and I can't quite remember what island it was around James Ross, but the scientists wanted to get to the top of this island. It was fairly impenetrable all the way around, but we managed to find a route through. And at the top, it was full of seashells. It was a raised beach.
Oh, really?
About probably about 700 foot high. And that sort of thing, it stays in your mind, really, because you don't expect to see it. Mm. So I think that's quite special, really.
Tell me about meeting Steve Martin.
Got back from James Ross Island, that's right. Crispin Day, who I'd been with, he had been arranged to go with him and Steve... And another guy called Nick Cox were set up to go across the Greenland ice cap. Crispin had mentioned this to me when we were on James Ross Island. And for me at the time, crossing the Greenland ice cap was the ultimate. That's what I wanted to do, you know. And I really wanted to manhole across Greenland. That's what I wanted to do. Because Nansen had done it, you know. You know, 100 years earlier and all the rest of it. I thought, you know, brilliant. I'd love to do that. Anyway, I'm sitting at home with my parents and the phone rings and a chap at the other end of the phone says, "Hello, my name's Steve Martin. You don't know me, but would you like to go to Greenland?" And I said, "Yes, I would like to go to Greenland." And he explained then that Crispin and Nick were unable to go. And Steve had asked Crispin if he knew anybody that would be interested, and Crispin had said, "Yes, I know this chap, Dave Mitchell, who would like to go." So Steve had rung me, and then the following day, Steve was living in Bristol at the time. He was trained to be a doctor. And the following day, I went down, drove down to Bristol, met him, and the rest is history, really. We just hit it off straight away. The third guy that was going on the trip, we hit it off as well, and we ended up putting an expedition together to, obviously, manhole across Greenland.
That was the summer of 89?
That was the summer
of 89. Was that a record-breaking trip? Did you get into the Guinness Book of Records? Or?
Not the Guinness Book of Records for that trip, but it was a record in terms of... it was the latest seasonal crossing of the Greenland ice cap at the time. And we wouldn't have gone that late other than Steve had his exams. So Steve had his medical exams on something like August the 28th, and we flew to Iceland on the 29th of August, something like that. And obviously then we then spent the next, well, it took us 55 days to walk across Greenland. And at the end of it, we've sort of finished up on the 1st of November, so it ended up being the latest seasonal crossing. And that really, for me, was the ultimate. I thought, wow, this is just fantastic to be able to have done this.
Is there a standout moment from that expedition?
There's a lot of standout moments from that trip because it was bloody cold. And we ended up really struggling because of the time of the year. We had a lot of fresh snow at the start. And for those not familiar with Greenland, it's a gradual climb up to 10,000 feet in the middle, and then obviously a slope back down to the sea on the other side over a 350-mile distance. And we really struggled with with the snow conditions in the first half of the trip. Steve, because of his exams, was in, and he'll admit it himself, was unfeasibly unfit to undertake such a trip because he'd done nothing but study for the last sort of 3 months. But got gradually fitter through the trip. We had a few. Again, at the time, looking back now, it probably should have been quite scary, but we had some very strong winds, 120 mile an hour winds. And we used to have to take sort of, we'd spend four, I think one time, which was 4 days, spending 1 hour on, 2 hours off, just holding the tent down inside, just and going out and digging it out, and because the wind was that strong, just moving into the kind of the autumn, winter period. Much as what we've got today, and it just got colder and colder. And we were very well prepared, very well prepared. We spent a lot of time in the summer designing a lot of our own kit, based on the experience I'd had in the Antarctic. Mm. Because both Steve and Keith weren't as outdoor orientated as I was at the time, because I was at that time I was right into it, climbing, skiing, everything you name it. I wanted to. So we spent a lot of time discussing what the best things to do would be, and then we ended up coming up with this kind of package of equipment and weights and food, and we designed our own diet and everything else to get across Greenland. And then we ended up... we took enough food for 55 days, and it took us 55 days. But we dumped 10 days of food, because when we got to the other side, because of the time of year, the crevasses hadn't filled in yet. And they were still very much open, but with a lot of soft snow on them. So we had to abandon our sledges about 3 miles from where the glacier ended. And we just had constant crevasses to cover. So we ended up dumping 10 days' food and taking... We took 6 days' food of half rations, I remember, split between us in rucksacks. So we'd gone down from quite a hefty calorific intake. The temperatures at this time were sort of generally around minus 40. And we were going with very lightweight kit, because we've only got 3 miles to do to get to the rock. And then we had about a 10-mile walk, effectively, then into Sondstrom, which was an American Air Force base. And it took us 9 days to do 3 miles. And that was a soul-searching period, really, because we had no contact with the outside world. We didn't have any radios. We didn't have any, obviously, there was no mobile phones then. But we did have a satellite beacon with us. And I do recall on something like the eighth day where it was getting dark. I think we only had 4 or 5 hours light at the time, so we couldn't travel in the dark on that glacier. It was just too horrific. And I remember, after about the eighth day, looking across at Steve in the tent, knowing that if we looked outside the tent, we could still see the sledges from a week earlier on some crevasses that were still further back. And he wouldn't look at me. And he wouldn't look at me because we were both asking ourselves the question, do we set off this satellite transponder? And we didn't. And... We were all very hungry, very cold. But the following day, we got onto rock. But effectively, we'd stopped crossing the crevasses by then. We decided to abseil into the bottom and walk along the bottom of the crevasses. So it was like being in this huge maze with, 100-foot ice walls all around you. And we just walked on the bottom of these crevasses for 2 days and popped out in this rock expanse. And 2 days later, we were eating fish and chips and drinking beer in the bar in the American base at Sondstrom. And that was an amazing trip. Amazing trip. Everybody was really worried at home because, obviously, they expected us to be finished by then. There was nothing. But fortunately, we managed to get a message back. And I was hooked.